are listening to 90.1 FM KPFT Houston.
Listeners should be aware that the following program contains language and audio images which may be found disturbing and may not be suitable for your snotty-nosed little brat who probably cusses like a sailor behind your back anyway. Parental discretion is advised.
We mean the electronic computer.
Greetings and welcome to this edition of a somewhat off-kilter Technology Bites.
Thank you for that, Inflicted.
That was awesome. We were just saying, you should just run that. Just do this on a loop. Just loop it and we'll just hang out.
And then take care of the first hour of the show.
Yep.
I feel like we need to go back to the Riviera and look for Sky Dog.
So.
That was pretty cool. Was that you? That was you, you were spinning that right there?
I chose the song.
Wow, you're like a real DJ.
He was unspinning chords.
Yeah.
Like C-O-R-D-S.
Well, you are listening to Technology Bites. I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Flicted.
I'm Barrett.
And I'm Bumley. I guess that's it.
Yeah, there's no Groovehouse, right?
No Groovehouse and no Jay. I didn't think anybody in Texas won the Powerball.
There's no engine and there's no caboose on this train.
Jay left us for Seattle.
Is that what he's doing?
He's taking
he's
selfies
become a
in Seattle.
Flannel wearing hippie. Jeez.
He's sleepless. He might have mail.
He's meeting some.
That was New York, though, so yeah, that's wrong coast.
It's like the same movie, though.
Pretty much it is. Yeah, thank you. It is the same basically movie.
The same right. Movie.
Right. So, anyways, as we try and pseudo prepare. After the network wasn't working when we first got here. So Jay's not here tonight. The usual informations that you need for our show. Geekradio.com is the website, and you can find out just about everything else you need to know there. We do have a link to the IRC, which if you have an IRC client, you can go to irc.cuckoo.com.
Cuckoo.
Groovehouse.
Wow, the ghost of Groovehouse. Or if you have no idea what an IRC client is, but you do want an online chat, you can go to geekradio.com and there's a link to our
completely
our highly secure Java-based, just tell it you trust it application.
Click yes.
And just give yourself a give yourself an interesting name like, oh, say, guest user 123 so that everybody knows who you are.
If you've never been in IRC, come on in. Type, I think it's /Nick, N-I-C-K, and then hit your space bar and then whatever you want to be.
Ooh, be whoever you want to be. On the internet, nobody knows that you're a dog.
But people are trying to, who is the, was it a senator that's saying, hey, there should no longer be anonymity on the internet?
That comes up every so often
from people who are idiotic.
That's why I don't read the news. I just read things and it irritates me. People calling for, like, I think it was Ted Cruz that's calling for encrypt everything. I mean, no, don't encrypt everything. Back doors for everybody. Key escrow for everybody. Complete draconian.
I think that's pretty much the Republican field for president is calling for that. And most of them, I don't know if, well, Rand Paul, just to be so totally fair, the whole Republican is not saying it. But I believe Rand Paul is against the whole backdoor thing. But the rest of them love them some backdoors.
Europe's battling it out, too. I think France, who's kind of, they're kind of French, they came out and they said, we want backdoors. But the Netherlands, who kind of, you know, staunch World War II, you know, resistance, they came out and said, no, encryption's good. Everyone should have encryption. So it's kind of cool to see how Europe is falling along the different, you know, political and country lines.
It seems to me the kind of the pro-encryption thing is people who are just lazy. It's like, it's the cop who sits in the station and goes, why don't the criminals just have to, like, send us a letter before they go and rob a stop and go kind of thing? You know, just like, lay it out for us, the stingray thing, you know, where they built in where they had a non-disclosure from the company that made the stingray is the, quote, reason.
So they all have that. That's like
the most important thing. The most important thing about it, but it allowed them. They used that as an excuse to lie in court.
Yeah, and that's there are still a lot of programs out there where they say, like, hey, we can't divulge how we got this information because it would compromise the program, and they're doing that a lot.
Yeah, and in some cases they'll drop the lawsuit. Whether the prosecutor will abort the prosecution rather than include as part of the discovery the methods
used. Because
we
all know how important corporations are as compared to the life of people who were the victims of crimes or perhaps the...
No. This is all to stop terrorism and to save the children. You're not following
stop
the right script.
Stop my fears. What else can I give up?
Hold on. I thought it was all to slow down lines at the airport. I think we're confused on what we're trying to accomplish now.
No. It's all about saving the children
it's all
and stopping terrorism.
It's security theater 20... The 21st century security theater.
What are we doing about terrorist children? That's what I want to know. Not nearly
well,
enough.
Well, they aren't going to wear any damn shoes or bring more than 16 ounces of formula on the plane. We know that.
Take that, baby terrorists.
Yeah. I'm flying in a couple of weeks, and I am not looking. I'm already not looking forward to the flying part of the flying.
Is it?
We've got a baby
domestic,
face, but you're kind of a full grown man at this point.
It's just domestic. The last time I flew was in October. I think it was in October, and on that trip and on the several trips before it, because I flew a bunch this year. I flew a bunch in 2015. I guess it's not this year, it's next year now. The TSA pre-line at every airport I've been at for the past several flights has been way longer than the normal person line. Everybody's now signed up for pre. And now, granted, the pre-line moves faster because, you know, at least in theory, the people who have it are, you know, relatively regular travelers. They know the routine. You don't have to take your shoes off and it's, you know, quicker. But when it's like, you know, the pre-line is like out through like four turnstiles and like the non-pre-line is like three people and they've got like 12 open lanes and there's one pre like X-ray scanner.
That's when you downgrade.
That's when you just like downgrade and hope that as you like walk over to the other line, they're not like.
As you downgrade yourself, that person either staggers or limps up to the thing, and you know that now you've just chosen the line that's still going to be slower than
right.
the line.
I do that in grocery stores, too. Like, my ability to choose the slowest line, it's amazing.
So you choose the line, and then the person pulls out the checkbook, like, yeah, no, I'll at hop, the like, very end of the transaction.
It can be one person in front of me, and I could be behind, you know, 30 people, and I'll go behind the one person, and they're the person that, you know, like, they have the heart attack, and they've got to call this, and they need to write the check, and they've
there's
got
no
the
UPC
pennies,
code.
They've got the coupons,
they
have got the price
something.
Check.
Change and some hard candy for you,
Sonny. Now.
On
the other side of that, though, the ones that drive me the craziest, if we're complaining about the grocery store.
As long as we're complaining
are, you know, children are wonderful. I'm glad if you have them, but if you allow them to operate the self-checkout line when there is a line of people behind you, you need to die.
Oh, look, he can't hardly swipe it across.
Must be this tall to
he's
ride this
trying, line. He's trying so hard. What a sweet youngster.
Oh, we're getting off in the weeds here.
So speaking of one more weedy kind of thing, so there's the Freedom of Information Act usually doesn't turn up very much.
Yes.
Someone was trying to figure out, and I forget exactly what the auspices were, but they're trying to figure out exactly what the NSA was looking at or doing something, and more or less they got 50 pages of everything was redacted, a whole bunch of lines, maybe like, you know, I'd say of, in, the, would be there. But they messed up, and there were just a small, very small handful of pages that came out, and it mentioned the FBI's tracking technology unit, the TTU. So it's like their surveillance unit, which is never mentioned. Like, we know money goes there, we know it exists, we know they do training, but you can't find this in documents. And they never give it up when people do the FOI requests for this, you know, particular kind of area of the FBI, nothing ever comes back.
It doesn't exist.
This, they accidentally leaked a whole bunch of stuff, and it's pretty crazy. There's definitely Stingray stuff in there. There's phone stuff in there. And a lot of the stuff, the thing that kind of bothered me was just the PowerPoint slides, a lot of the training, was just the cavalier. It's like hacker kids wrote it the way they're like, you know, this is how you own cars. And they were calling him like Johnny Donuts was like the bad guy. Like, this is how you get Johnny's Donuts. It's like, come on, guys. Aren't you like, you know, professional... Well, I guess not.
Meanwhile,
they're breaking the law.
I believe the FBI has said they can't hire enough hackers to do stuff for them because all the hackers that they can find use marijuana and they won't, or have in the past or something, and can't pass the drug test.
Oh, I think I remember reading that. It's becoming basically like, I mean, not just accepted, it's just becoming de rigueur at this point. And yeah. You can't hire anybody to work in the federal government because you have to take that drug test and nobody's clean.
So they remember like when all the cops were putting the GPS units on the cars and stuff like that. So apparently this
like in Breaking Bad.
Yeah, this was the letter that came out. So it shipped with a kid and they had the cover letter and it said, "Welcome to the wonderful world of Redacted. Now you can watch the activities of Joey Bag of Donuts. Huge Redacted. All you need is on Redacted and a Redacted on Bag of Donuts car." And it says, let's open the case. Inside, you'll find packing list, photo of kind of, sort of, how the case is arranged. Actually, put things in the most convenient place to fit them. So it's extremely casual and an information sheet. So these things were like, it looks like a garage kind of thing, clandestine. One guy was making all these kits, hand-type stuff, handwritten instructions, and shipping them out. But this is how the FBI was, you know, equipping all these police departments to track whoever they wanted to track.
Beautiful.
I think there is a whole kind of underground industry in that stuff, because I dealt with a guy who was selling, he was not putting himself forth as the inventor of this, but he apparently had made some enhancements. You know the deals that they throw across, the deal where you throw it across the street and then it pops up the spines and then the car drives over?
Oh, yeah.
And it pops
yeah,
the
spike strips.
The spike strips. Well, he had worked with a guy who I don't think he was the guy who invented it either. But he was trying to – I was working at a place that did websites and a company that did websites, and he wanted us to do him a website. And the – you know, clearly it was just a line of very unusual people, I guess would be the best way to put it, all the way down, all the way back to whoever had originally come up with the thing. And then all of them did their own like little tweak that would work better I don't think he ever ended up finishing his site with us, but it was just there's all those tools that the police use. There's this whole kind of quiet secret. They're not advertising it out. You know, they don't go out at CES and show you this stuff. That it's all on the QT, and it's kind of, you know, I don't know. It just sort of seems like, why should that be secret?
Yeah, there's like 15 or 20 pages of TTU devices used for tracking that have all been redacted for covert tracking. So there's a whole smorgasbord of things you can order from,
I sort of get the intelligence community, although in the crime community, basically the overlap between those is not surprising.
No, and classes, the vehicle install and tracking technologies class.
All the military tech at the police and all that, of course, they're also... Well, because what? The New York Police Department has an intelligence unit. They had a whole thing. I think they finally stopped it because they were going way too far. I mean, they were sending people overseas to investigate stuff. And
we are so political right now, but I will say the technology that they're getting, because it used to be, you know, you look at like the SWAT teams, and you know, like New York's a good example of that because they've got the money and they've got, you know, that large of city. They used to have the weapons, you know, like weapons you'd only see like at graded military stuff. But now they're getting the same kind of technologies and the same listening technologies and the same kind of surveillance technologies. And it's the line between, you know, police and military. It's getting kind of blurry as far as, you know, the tools that they've got available to them.
At least by appearance, I have a feeling if you stacked them all up.
Oh, yeah. Police versus military, yeah, I think that'd be over fairly quickly.
No, I'll catch up with you guys.
Joey Bag of Donuts, wait! But it is important, like all these rumors of all these, you know, like weird clandestine, you know, tinfoil hat programs to spy on people and do things, they're very, very real. And, you know, the documents keep leaking, and it's they're trying to keep a lid on what's out there, but they're having a hard time.
My personal feeling is that a lot of this is going to look like... In 20 or 30 years, when it gets disclosed, when they open the files or it becomes so old or out of date or whatever, that it's going to be like, I don't know if you've heard the FBI file on Martin Luther King, where they were sending him letters. They were sending his wife letters that said he was having a lot of affairs and trying to ruin his life. And it was all written by like the same people at the FBI.
Well, you've got to wonder. I mean, we've been desensitized. Well, maybe you're not desensitized.
How effective was it?
Yeah, with like MK Ultra, like all those things where, you know, the government actually did, you know, experiment
with LSD
on soldiers with LSD, or like, you know, the Tuskegee experiments, or just all the atrocities that we've had. You know, those we no longer accept that. But right now, you know, we are accepting mass surveillance. We're accepting being spied on. And I think in, you know, 20 or 30 years, it's not going to be the same atrocity. Like, I can't believe they, you know, gave men syphilis. But it's going to be like, I can't believe, you know, people of 2015, 2016, let them get away with this. That's just, it's obviously kind of wrong. And I think in 20 or 30 years, history is going to say it's wrong. And
they're
going to look
say
back
that
and it's
and
going
go,
to be weird.
And look, we found all of the footage they saved of the naked scanners that they were using in the airport.
I hope at some point they'll be able to release everything. And we can just go, you know, when I'm old and I've got like nothing to do in the nursing home, I can just go back and like read the transcript of this conversation we're having right now.
Yeah.
So that'd be kind of fun, you know.
On your FOI request, in your FBI file.
What
very political on technology bias.
What magic words do we need to say to make sure this gets captured?
Let's not.
Echelon.
I'm pretty sure. MK Ultra.
Echelon. I guess Echelon is the old. Carnivore.
Lamppost.
Lamp.
What are some of the old ones? What was the one that they used to be able to read monitors through walls? Tempest. Did we already say Tempest?
No.
There are a lot of code words. These are old school ones, but, you know, they're all out there. Then all the cool ones just sound silly now. They used to sound kind of cool, the code words.
Carnivore.
Tempest. Now it's like egotistical giraffe. And it is. This is real. Exploding chipmunk. I don't know if that was one of them. Silliness.
It's a lot less. I guess it's a lot less. Well, it's still Tempest. It's kind of hard to tell. But was that the one where they could read, like...
It was from the...
They could like, look at writes to a hard drive by the LED flash pattern or something?
Yeah, Tempest was a lot of being able to tell what was going on in computers without being tied into the network. So air gaps, getting past air gaps. And I was, like, looking at network traffic by the LEDs blinking because... No, there's no firm. There is now, but back in the day on the slower networks, there was no firmware that said, "Hey, when there's network traffic, blink the LED." What would happen when a packet would come down or when anything would come down, the electrical connection would blink that LED. And if you could, you know, really zone in on that, slow it down with a high speed camera, you could probably reconstruct a lot of the network traffic that was going across. And it sounds silly, but they were doing that. You know, they were bouncing lasers off windows to see the vibrations, to hear what was going on in the room. They were reading the EMI, you know, what was given off by the monitors, and being able to read that through walls. I think that was that
I think
Tempest?
That was Tempest.
I think that was Tempest.
Tempest was monitor.
Yeah, so more or less they have the laundry van out there parked across the street. They can see what's on your monitor. You know, you don't have to get on the network. They don't have to get anything. They can see pretty much everything you see.
All these flickery images of porn from your monitor being translated.
Thousands of pop-ups of porn.
There you go.
Or, you know, maybe documents from the Soviet embassy or whatever. You know, maybe.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. But then you read about the old school. You know, we're all the high-tech company or country. And then you read about the stuff that the Soviets got away with, like where we had the embassy that was just laced with listening devices.
The best one was the seal, the Great Seal. That was a gift from, I'm going to look this up, Soviet SEAL Embassy Listening Device.
Well, you do that. I know that there were some, I've read stories of, they knew that some rooms were compromised, so they would use those as misinformation sources to go in and say, hey, we're doing this, we're doing that, and they go out and snicker, you know. Yeah, wow, but they're snickering probably in another room that was tapped, so, you know.
This was a thing called The Thing. The Thing, reading this off of Wikipedia, also known as the Great SEAL Bug, that's S-E-A-L, not
Little bug.
Yes.
Like listening device.
Was one of the first covert listening devices, or bugs, to use passive techniques to transmit an audio signal. It was concealed inside a gift given by the Soviets to the U.S. ambassador to Moscow on August 4th, 1945. Because it was passive, being energized and activated by electromagnetic energy from an outside source, it is considered a predecessor of RFID technology. This thing sat in... invented. The thing was designed by Soviet Russian inventor Leon Theremin, who is best known for inventing the theremin.
Everyone, check your theremins
that
right now.
It was a really cool listening device.
Yeah,
it was hidden inside the great.
It was hidden inside. And they've got a picture of it on the Wikipedia article. Hidden inside, you know.
I forgot who it was. They gave it as a gift to a guy.
The U.S. ambassador.
Yeah, U.S. ambassador, and I want to say like they gave it to him, and then. He put it on the wall, or maybe he didn't, but the next guy did. Anyway, it was on the wall, and that guy left, but the next guy had it on the wall, and they couldn't figure out how they knew some things.
It was
a number of years, I'm pretty sure.
It looks like 6 years.
Yeah.
Bahaha. What years was that? Was that during the Cold War?
They noticed there was a van.
Oh, wow, right after World War II.
Outside a lot, outside the embassy a lot, and they were like, why is that van sitting there all the time? But they couldn't figure it out, because they, check for bugs inside the office and over and over and over. And eventually, I forgot, somebody figured it out because they started listening for frequencies.
Yeah, they were doing a security sweep with radio, just scanning frequencies, and they happened to catch it
when the van was there,
beaming the thing in there. And so they figured out what it was, they pulled it down, and then they were able to reverse engineer it, and everyone was like, oh, man.
That's brilliant.
Yeah.
Give them credit for that. All right.
That was neat.
Yeah. Maybe we should move forward with the.
Are we going to segue into an info show?
Oh, I thought you were going to say maybe
no,
we should
we're going
do
to
all spy show
into flames. So, you ready to push the button?
We'll see what happens.
Take it away, info shot.
You're no Julie.
It's the Technology Bites Info Shot. Technology news and commentary by Peter Hughes. Injected directly into your skull.
Well, we were
talking
about...
Sounds like they had a chorus effect on it or something. That was weird.
Well, it goes like from channel to channel.
I just thought it was something you were doing. Everything's new this week.
I had my foot on the wah-wah pedal. Sorry.
We were talking about terrorism. And this one's interesting. The security firm called PKWare made this prediction.
Wait a minute, PKWare.
Know that up front.
PKZip and.
It just says security firm PKWare.
Huh. All right.
Said that ISIS is likely to launch a cyber attack on a major corporation this year, according to PKWare CEO Miller Newton. These extreme terrorist groups are just unconstrained, and we know the destructive nature of their physical attacks. I don't discern any distinction between those motives physically and in the cyber warfare realm. So the first blows of cyber warfare for terrorists will happen this year. You know, I guess that would be really a big, you know, hair on fire, oh my gosh thing. If, say, Sony hadn't already been hacked by a foreign something. And, you know, actually, so I'm being a little bit sarcastic, but, you know, there are one of the things I saw an article and I couldn't find it for this newscast, but there are cyber attacks against infrastructure in Ukraine right now. The article is sort of odd because it's kind of like we just have no idea who could be attacking the infrastructure of Ukraine.
Huh.
Because, of course, there is no Russian involvement in that area of the world, so it couldn't possibly be their hackers. But, you know, apparently there is direct that is being done. It is something that clearly, as a tool, it's going to happen. It's being explored, and it's going to get used. And the sad part is, though, when this stuff's around long enough, when your average script kiddie can get their hands on it, what happens then? I mean,
they've definitely upped the game. There's been, you know, quote unquote cyber war between those two, you know, countries for a while, but it used to be, it started out as just effacement of websites and, you know, like, you know, .ru is lame and, you know, the crank and blah, blah, blah. But it's gotten to where they got into businesses and there's been a lot of collateral. And now I don't know if it's just, you know, like the armchair hackers or if it sounds like it's state sponsored now, the attacks going on in the Ukraine.
Well, but Stuxnet, I think, woke up a lot of countries that maybe weren't pushing hard on it to the fact that
you
can air gap, you can jump the gap to stuff that's not even connected to the internet and that infrastructure, that kind of attack stuff clearly got on the table. And, you know, also the fact that once people knew what it did, then suddenly that Stuxnet that was sitting around all over the place inactive meant you had a sample of it that you could then take apart and figure out, you know, and so on. I'm guessing it must be insanely complex, though, or we would have seen more Stuxnet-style stuff showing up. It doesn't seem like anybody's really yet reverse-engineered it all the way. Besides whoever actually engineered it. The other ISIS, the other terrorism story, and this one, it's one where you kind of, you know, on the free speech side of the coin, you go, well, you know, free and open internet. And on the other side of the coin, it's like, do we really want to give these people an avenue to communicate and to get out to the world? Google's head of ideas, Jared Cohen, said in London this week that the terror group ISIS must be pushed off of the open web if it is to be hindered from spreading its message online. Cohen, whose responsibility at Google is to build tools to fight oppression, made the comments on Monday during a talk with the Royal Institute of International Affairs in London, as reported by The Guardian. Cohen said it won't be possible to push ISIS from the dark web, commonly accessed by a small number of more advanced internet users using the Tor network, so the focus must be spent on removing and combating the terrorist organization's propaganda on the traditional internet that can be indexed by search engines. And the idea, I guess, the thing about it is, here it is, it's written in a little bit different language, but, you know, ISIS has been exploiting the open internet to radicalize young people. Read, for the children, have to do it. I must say I'm sort of torn on that one. I've
heard an argument on the other side too. So right after the attacks in France happened, like Anonymous, you know, got together and said, "Hey, let's go do Anonymous stuff." And they went after and they started shutting down a lot of, not necessarily the dark web stuff, but a lot of the ISIS channels on YouTube, on Twitter, you know, just trying to round up, identify them, and shut them down. And there was a lot of backlash against them from the actual legitimate security communities saying, hey, don't do that, because at least right now we can watch them. We can see who's being converted. We can see who's going to the sites. We can see who's publishing content. We know it is. Versus if once you eradicate them, the only place they're going to have to go is the dark web, and it's a lot harder for us to see what's going on when they go
shut down one YouTube channel, and their cell phone rang, and the guy said, hey, I was watching that. No, but I think there, you know, it's a tough one. I would think that it would be better if there's more of a discussion of it. And the problem is, I don't know if it's possible for there to be a public discussion without sort of security trollery. You're in favor of murdering children then, right? Kind of thing. And you don't want us to be safe and all that. So, you know, it seems to me that, frankly, if it's something you can find by Googling it, if it's that open, then why not leave it open? I guess in the end, I kind of come down on the side of, if their ideas are that weak or strong, if their ideas are that strong, just trying to hide them wouldn't make it go away. And if their ideas are out there competing with everybody else's, then, like everything else on the internet, people can read it and decide for themselves. But so, anyways, I just thought that was interesting, especially since it's someone from Google talking about it, and you know, but it does start getting into, you know, one of the things that Cohen mentions is to combat ISIS's open web reach, its social media accounts must be taken offline as soon as they appear. And it's kind of, where's that line go? You know, social media, there's a study from George Washington University that says that social media activity played a crucial role in radicalization and mobilization to Iraq and Syria, again, according to The Guardian. Which, the thing about it is, though, social media as a motivator for fill in the blank kind of works anyway, but... So I just – it seemed interesting to me, that question. And just a quickie aside, there's an ad industry conference going on right now, and they kicked out an ad-blocking firm. So they're blocking – the ad industry is blocking an ad-blocking.
Did they chase them out with pitchforks and torches, or was it like
no,
a kindly
they just
do not?
Let them go
it's
to the conference.
It's the AdBlock Plus people.
Oh, wow.
They were registered at it's an international ad conference, and they had registered to attend, and they were going to be one of the – I think they were going to do a session or something, or they were going to do a keynote or whatever. But they had paid to attend. It's not like a freebie. You don't just show up. It's a, you know, you pay, and then you attend the conference. And out of nowhere, the conference refunded the AdBlock Plus people's money.
So as attendees or as exhibitors?
As
attendees? Because that's a big little bit of a difference. Blocking attendees is pretty harsh. These exhibitors, I can see, like, hey, that doesn't go in line with our conference of pushing ads on unwilling people.
It was,
I'm guessing vendor or exhibitor.
Their registration exhibitor. Had registration been canceled fee. And the fee refunded is what it says.
Okay, yeah, according to the AdBlock Plus blog, the company had bought a ticket for the IAB conference.
So
just
is,
to be clear,
just
there will
attendee?
Be no ticket available for you, and we've refunded your registration.
Yeah,
fee.
So they were just attending.
Wow.
And they were like, nope. Yeah, they didn't like ask for a refund. It was simply refunded, and the AdBlock Plus people were like, hey, was there a mix-up? We, you know, you guys refunded our ticket, and the conference organizers were like, no, there was no mix-up.
You've been blocked.
You yes, we AdBlock you, AdBlock people.
Oh, well, so they didn't let him register, but then they actually are supposed to speak on stage.
Okay. Yeah.
Just interesting to see that one. I just liked the headline that sort of linked Beatty. And now the litany of – no, there's only two, so I guess that's not a litany. But a couple of flaws, security flaws of the week. Ding.
Dun, 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 dun.
Who's our winner this week? Well, our big winner this week is the serious flaw that was patched in the Intel driver update utility. Isn't that great? Isn't that where you want to hear about there being a flaw when they can get at the
like
motherboard
level
of your machine? a software utility that helps users download the latest drivers for their Intel hardware components contained a vulnerability that could have allowed man-in-the-middle attackers to execute malicious code on computers. The tool known as the Intel Driver Update Utility can be downloaded from Intel's support website. It provides an easy way to find the latest drivers for various Intel chipsets, graphic cards, wireless cards, desktop boards, Intel Nook mini PCs, or the Intel Compute Stick. The vulnerability stems from the tool using unencrypted HTTP connections to check for driver updates. Nice. Nice.
No.
Yeah. And then if that didn't work, it would call 867-5309, I believe.
Uh-huh.
The fallback.
Right.
Flaw was discovered by researchers from Core Security and was reported to Intel in November. The chipmaker fixed the issue and released an updated version of the tool on Tuesday. So you don't have to worry unless you're using the old one. And, of course, one of the pluses is if you do the upgrade, then you don't have to worry about somebody taking advantage of this now that it's been announced. The other one is, and both of these are ones that have apparently been fixed, Yahoo email had a critical flaw, which might have allowed attackers to hijack accounts. It has been fixed. The vulnerability would have allowed the embedding of malicious JavaScript code in tailored email messages. A victim would have needed to do nothing but read the message, which would then execute the code and give cyber attackers the ability to fully compromise the account, hijack settings, and either forward or send email to the attacker's server without the victim's knowledge or consent. It was fixed in early January, not long after Yahoo was informed about it. So, you know, kudos to them on that one. And the other, probably the most important part about this story, they were informed about it through its HackerOne bug bounty program, And it was disclosed privately to the Sunnyvale, California-based company by security researcher Juko Pinonen. I'm guessing he's probably Finnish, and I don't know how you say that umlauted O in the middle of his name. Pinonen, maybe?
Is he German?
Noonan.
You say Noonan. It's pronounced $10,000.
He was awarded...
Nope, no help there. Can't help you. No idea.
Yeah, real shortage of characters that we can just phonetically do. He was awarded $10,000 for his efforts. So that's good. And the person who found it said the vulnerability was patched before it affected any real-world users. According to the researcher, the problem lay in how Yahoo filters HTML-formatted email messages. While the company performs this test to prevent malicious code from landing in user inboxes, certain malformed HTML code could get past it. And he did a proof of concept with a video, so that's pretty cool. Or somebody did a proof of concept video that showed it working. I guess better news. This is sort of science-y, but it didn't really fit under to wait to weird science. A group of scientists have created an innovative hydrogen fuel nanoreactor that could make hydrogen cars a whole lot cheaper. Indiana University scientists just announced they managed to create a highly efficient biomaterial that takes in protons and, quote, spits out, unquote, hydrogen gas called P22HID, H-Y-D.
Total protonic reversal.
This modified enzyme can be grown using a simple room temperature fermentation process, making it much more eco-friendly and considerably cheaper than the material used in fuel cells like platinum. I mean, that's one of the problems. You know, fuel cells is that you've got to have all the really serious you've got to have all the serious chemicals or serious metals that are rare and all that.
Also really helps if you have a big supply of liquid oxygen and liquid hydrogen in
right,
advance.
Yeah, and you can't do it at room temperature. The deal is apparently this works at room temperature on a massive scale using fermentation technology. So here's another big plus for beer.
Brew while you drive.
My theory. That's my theory is they came up with this by thinking, hey, couldn't we just brew hydrogen? It'll be like kimchi, but it'll produce hydrogen instead of sulfur.
I like kimchi.
The way the enzyme is created is interesting in its own right. Researchers used two genes from E. coli bacteria inserted into the capsid or viral protein shell of a second virus. These genes then produce hydrogenase, the enzyme that sets off the hydrogen reaction. That may sound a little complicated, so it is. So you're not going to be doing this at home, I don't think. Lead author of the study, Trevor Douglas, admits that in the past it's been hard to harness hydrogenase for biofuel production due to its sensitivity to environmental conditions like warm temperatures. The new method creates enzymes that are much more stable, allowing it to be used more efficiently. Hopefully this discovery will help drive down the cost of hydrogen cars because currently they retail for between $50,000 and $100,000. And there is no Tesla of hydrogen cars.
Toyota was supposed to make something. They said in 2013 they're going to have a fuel cell car, which is pretty much what the hydrogen cars are. But yeah, I haven't heard
Honda
of anyone actually doing it.
I think Honda has one that they're going to. It was a Honda or Toyota.
It was one of them.
Toyota said they were going to do it, I know for sure.
Hydrogen has.
And then secretive startup Hindenburg Motors.
Well, I was gonna, hydrogen has, for better or for worse, some, let's call it, storability issues.
Kind of bad track record with
hydrogen.
But this
is creating it in the fuel cell for...
Yeah, you know what, and that's really a good thing, because hydrogen's kind of funky. I mean, it's really light. It has, as a fuel, it has one of the highest specific impulses that you can get out of a fuel if you're going to burn it. A specific impulse is kind of the measure of how efficiently a thing burns for a given amount of mass of that thing. But it's also hella explosive. And if you're going to store it in liquid form, it's hella cold. It is one of the coldest cryogens that there is. So storing it in liquid form is very problematic. Storing it in gaseous form is very explosive. It's just a problematic fuel.
It's the perfect element.
It's great if you are a government agency and you have rockets and you need rocket fuel. It's an outstanding rocket fuel because of its high specific impulse. It just, you know, it's very difficult to, you know, do anything with.
There was, although one thing you can do that's really cool for science class, there was a I would guess that he is not still among us, but a science educator.
Don't play with hydrogen.
His last name was Shakashiri, and he came through town. His thing was that teaching science didn't have to be boring, and so it wasn't like Mr. But well, except that it also wasn't just put on a show and the kids don't really know anything more when you're done. But I went and saw his presentation at Rice. This was in
presentation.
He had these garbage bags that were floating up behind the. He had a big, you know, workbench at the front of the room.
Were they filled with hydrogen?
Like in a lab, and he took candles on sticks.
Yeah,
and
I've
stuck
seen
them
this
up there.
On
and boom! Well, he was doing that. This was in '83, so it gives you an idea how long ago this guy was doing.
Oh, the humanity!
But well, except part
it's
of it was
back when
you
could
that,
blow stuff up in class and spank kids. You know, school's changed.
Yeah, well, let's see. We were thrilled by one and scarred by the other, and I'll let you guess which one was which. But no, yeah, blowing up the hydrogen stuff, I think part of it was kind of a counterweight to the whole kind of Hindenburg hydrogen, you know, people imagining their hydrogen fuel cell cars, you know, exploding.
Well,
and
to be fair, on the other side of that, there are a lot of other problems with the Hindenburg. You can't really hold that up as like a paragon of safety and like the hydrogen was its undoing. There's a lot of other stuff going on there.
I mean, making a, you know, ship-sized thing out of balsa wood and flash-flammable paint isn't a good idea?
I finally saw the movie The Martian. They had issues with that, too.
With Hindenburg?
No, with hydrogen. I think Matt Damon blew himself
up. Oh, yeah.
Up.
That was where he was trying to
extract out of his hydrogen fuel.
It wasn't hydrogen fuel. It was hydrazine.
It was hydrazine,
which they I can't remember if they did that wrong or not, because like hydrazine is, of course, you know, just corrosively toxic and will kill you so dead. It is poisonous. It is just massively poisonous. And I think in the movie he actually would have exposed himself to some of the hydrazine. And in the book that scene actually plays on quite a bit longer when he accidentally fills the habitat up with hydrogen. In the movie it's like boom and like, oh, I burned my eyebrows off. In the book it's like a big deal.
So really quick, was the book funny? Was that like a Tom
Robinson?
Oh, yeah. Robinson?
Yes. The book is hilarious.
So I was very confused. The whole reason I watched it, because I heard it was classified as a comedy for the Golden Globes. So that might have been...
Really?
Yeah, no, it was. So apparently because...
I mean, it has funny moments.
People laughed during it, but then...
No, it won. It went into the comedy section, and this, I think, what it was it was the directors or whatever forces that be put these movies into the categories. It was the same studio, and they said, oh, we've already got like a drama that's going to win. We want to get this movie some legs, so let's put it in comedy and pay for it to win in comedy. So it did. So yeah, The Martian got like best comedy or something like that in the Golden Globes.
Yeah,
which
it did. It got comedy awards.
I mean, okay, so it has funny.
But I watched it and it was a drama.
I didn't think of it as a comedy.
They showed the clip and he burned off his eyebrows and then they added in
a laugh track.
Right, it's a laugh track. Laugh track would be interesting behind that movie.
I thought that was weird too. Yeah, when I was looking at the Golden Globes and
so
they,
he was
won
just so that
and
they
the Martian
won
it was in the comedy
yeah so that they
section.
Could just give it something and not that I'm all you know into Hollywood and whatever, but it does in a way legitimate comedies like movies that try to be funny.
Yeah.
Like maybe like the what was it the Something Eight or the Something Six or whatever the Dangerous or
the Hateful Eight
that's thank you.
Not a
is
comedy.
That not a comedy
the Ridiculous Six
never mind
you know,
Ridiculous
what?
Six like what there were some numbers with comedies
okay.
Point being is it stole Thunder away from something that's trying to be a
that's
comedy.
That's from like Billy
Madison.
The problem is that that guy, whatever his name is,
Sandler.
Sandler, the guy I don't like.
The Ridiculous Six was apparently less successful. I think that honestly, The Martian was a better comedy than The Ridiculous Six.
I mean,
but not knowing anything about The Ridiculous Six, is that a play on The Hateful Eight? Are those two in any way linked or no?
No, it's more like The Magnificent Seven.
Oh, okay.
And then The Ridiculous Six.
And then The Hateful Eight is also a play on
The
Magnificent Seven.
A group of people who in the Old West who are related and they're looking for
But
something.
Going on the title, I would think The Ridiculous Six sounds more like a comedy than does The Martian.
Well,
that sounds
what about
like sci-fi.
My favorite Martian.
They actually, when they
borderline, yeah.
That was the ad campaign. It's our new favorite Martian.
Yeah.
Some people thought that you know Roy Walston's ghost was in it.
But
Ray
I mean,
Walston.
To answer your question, the book is has probably the same mix of comedy and drama as the movie does.
Would
it has moments that are very,
a
very
comedy?
Funny.
No. Would you consider the book a
comedy?
I would
not consider it a comedy. Okay. It has moments in it that are very, very funny, and the narration style helps because, you know, the character...
Kind of have a sense of humor if you're...
I mean, it cuts back to Earth several times, but the majority of the book is his journal. And yeah, he's got the indomitable sense of humor. In fact, when I interviewed Andy Weir about that, the author, he said that... He very correctly pointed out that if you are, in fact, marooned on Mars for years, not no spoilers, but if you are, in fact, marooned on Mars for years
it's
alone...
called The Martian. I think people might have figured it out.
You, any normal human being would develop probably just crippling psychological issues from being that isolated for that long.
That alone and basically in constant risk of dying.
Oh yeah,
you'd go
nuts. And so he said, Andy Weir, the author, basically said that, you know, I wanted to write, you know, my story about sort of, you know, Robinson Crusoe in space. I didn't want to write a character study in crippling depression. So I just sort of wrote it and decided that Mark Watney, the character, he just doesn't roll that way. He's just okay with it. He is super optimistic, and that's just how it's going to be. So
spoiler alert, there is like a 20-minute, I guess, section there where Matt Damon does nothing but say, "How about them apples?" to himself over and over and over.
How
and
about
over.
Them apples?
I got her number.
How about them apples? How about them apples?
Rocket, man.
There is some disco in that movie, and actually there's a montage in that movie, and they use David Bowie's Starman, and it's actually my favorite use of Starman in a film. They do a great job putting it over the montage. If you haven't seen The Martian, go see The Martian. It's a fabulous movie.
Yeah, I think it's just
great comedy.
It's hitting the various on-demand
Golden Globe
and Red
award-winning
Box
comedy.
Stuff.
Yeah, I think
you
it's,
can
it's,
pay for it to stream it if you would like. Now,
yeah,
legally.
It's... You'll totally crack up when The Martian appears.
Matt Damon stars in a new wacky outer space adventure.
The craziest buddy movie of the year.
But there's no buddy. It's just Matt Damon.
He's on a spaceship by himself solving
He's got a
problem.
Space soccer ball. A volleyball. Space volleyball that he's painted a face on.
The honest.
But it's called Adidas because they had a whole branding thing with it.
The honest trailer for that movie, which is there's a dude who does these honest trailers on a YouTube channel, it started off with like, in a world where NASA is fully funded and people care about what it does. It was.
Well, okay, it's a comedy then. I get where
it's
a comedy.
True.
Well, this isn't comedy, but it. It's interesting,
oh,
and again, another sort of scientific... No, that's...
I forgot
that's
what we were doing.
News.
The format, it's
news.
Not like keep Info out, shot. You know? It's just, I know when I'm remote, it's hard.
Yeah, usually
to,
we just mute and just browse the web while you talk.
It's hard to talk. So,
just let you go.
No, this one is an interesting one, and hopefully people will think about it. And again, it's one that is in that blurry line between news and science. You know, finally... After way too many years, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the American College of Physicians is issuing joint guidance to say that however miserable you are with the common cold and various winter respiratory afflictions, don't go with a round of antibiotics as the first things to start. In the new set of guidelines published in the Annals of Internal Medicine, the ACP and the CDC give doctors a play-by-play for how to dodge requests for antibiotics to treat respiratory infections.
No, just say no.
The common reason people go to the doctor and push alternative over-the-counter treatments instead. Actually, I want to market my own product. It's called Placebo. It's an Italian remedy.
Is that cheese? Sounds like it's got cheese.
It's sweet. It's sweet.
I always think it was like horchata.
Yes.
But yes, placebo. Side effects of placebo include
feeling awesome.
Nothing happening.
Memory loss.
Side effects include whatever you can imagine.
I don't want when I go. I mean, if I'm sick and I've got a cold and it's like day three and I'm really dragging, I'm not really looking for antibiotics. I'm looking for like, what can you give me that's gonna make me stop coughing and sleep? Like, can I have some of that? What medicine can you give me that just makes me go to sleep?
It says here vodka and sure.
speaking as someone that never ever goes to the doctor, it is a little bit irritating when I do go, and it's like all the antibiotics that worked last time I went, they don't work anymore.
Nope.
And I'm allergic to like penicillin and erythromycin and all these different derivatives. So it's like there's only a very thin slice of antibiotics that work on me. So yeah, everyone, that what you're doing is you're treating everything with antibiotics. So you're making all these, you're creating all these antibiotic resistant strains of everything.
Throw antibiotics at everything.
Yeah.
Now at long last, they finally, because I mean, this has been out there for decades.
20, 30 years we've been worried about it. Yeah.
Well, and like everything's gone antibacterial, right? I mean, at first it was just like the little hand sanitizer antibacterial, and then they put it in hand soaps.
Yeah, it's
and then they put it in like makeup probably, and they started putting it like embedded into the cutting boards of your food. I mean, it's gotten out of control. Like, it's absurd.
Well, because they found something they could market. People are afraid. Well, because for a long time people didn't know what bacteria was. Then once they understood it,
well, 1600s.
Then, oh, it's bad. It's all bad.
Then Leeuwenhoek showed up.
Because they think it's all you know, the Black Death and all this stuff. And there's that whole thing about what there's basically roughly as many bacteria in your body, in each individual's body, as there are human cells by number. It's roughly equivalent.
It's very symbiotic.
And so this idea that, no, if we could just get rid of all bacteria, then it's all going to be fine.
You might have problems digesting your food.
Well, they found, and, you know, okay, spoiler alert or trigger warning, whatever you want to say. You know, childbirth, what's the modern conception, meaning the past, so 50 years of childbirth, is what, the sterile room type environment? It's all clean and white and sterilized.
Who knew that operating on cadavers
out, well, no, they figured out
was
they,
bad.
They figured out that, you know, birth and, you know,
a little bit of like immunization.
If you're there and participate in childbirth with someone, if, you know, obviously as a guy, I'm just there to, like, offer moral support and bring more crushed
to cringe.
It is a messy process, and this whole idea, the whole concept, or oh no, we'll make it just this clean and easy process. It there's no way for it to be. And then the other side of it is, it turns out, you know, here's the jump to the end spoiler alert thing. Turns out, exposing the newborn baby to all that bacteria and all the messiness of childbirth is spectacular for them. They need it. It's built in. It's like, it's almost like over millions of years as humanity reproduced, that then somehow there was some competitive advantage to getting your bacteria right immediately when you were born. And I think it's called evolution. And so this idea where, oh, what we think is ooky or not clinging or whatever happens to work very differently in reality is something that I think a lot of people maybe need to kind of wake up to. The same people who want to go to the doctor and have him give them an anti-cold, common cold pill.
So I read a really – I'll make this real quick. I know we're headed toward break here. So Ignaz Semmelweis, who is the German physician who is behind the whole thing where you shouldn't do an autopsy and then immediately go over and help deliver children in the late 1800s, late 19th century.
Okay, now I get that one. Dragging corpses.
No. Seriously, up until relatively recently, in 1850s and 60s, that was still kind of like the thing to do.
Yep, die to the plague. Gotta deliver it.
There were
no time to wash my hands.
In the Vienna General Hospital where he worked, there were two wards. There was a ward served by doctors, and there was another ward served by midwives only. And because the doctors would frequently, and you've heard most of the story, because the doctors would frequently like go and do their surgical stuff and work on cadavers and then walk sort of across the hallway and then help deliver babies. There was, you know, massive childbirth death and the women would die all the time. But in the midwives ward, where the midwives were only delivering babies, there was a considerably lower mother mortality during delivery. And the prevailing theory on why the women were dying, before everybody figured out that, oh, if you put your hands inside of a cadaver, you get dead people germs on you, before they figured that part out, was that the women were dying of shame for being attended by a man during delivery.
Boy, duh.
So then they hired a squad of women that then the doctors instructed.
Well, because the midwives weren't, everyone was
and
alive.
And then walking into the, it just sort of interesting.
I think to bring it back to the tech thing, I think that we do need like a lot of just pestilence and disease and just harmful bacteria coursing through our bodies. So when we go explore other alien worlds and experience encounter other aliens, we don't have to actually fight wars with them. We just do what we did when we came to the U.S.
Right.
And yeah, boom.
To make it real crystal clear, do you want to be the alien from Alien when you go out there into the hostile?
Or do you want to be the alien from War of the Worlds?
Or do you want to be SpongeBob? You know, kind of spongy, soft, and vulnerable, and so on. On a totally different, and this also still relates to tech, though, but we also don't have, an entertainment category. I should have just slotted this in after The Martian.
You should have.
This one actually is a comedy. There is going to be a musical comedy about the rise and rivalry of tech luminaries Bill Gates and Steve Jobs.
Didn't we already have that?
Poorly titled Nerds.
Didn't
it
we
should
already,
be called Nerds.
Didn't we already have Pirates of Silicon? I guess it was
a
movie.
Wasn't
no,
a
that
musical.
Was different. This is a musical.
Okay.
This is
the musical.
Although they did
comedy.
Already have a PBS did a show called Nerds. Or
Nerds!
Nerds 2.0.
Well, and I guess Revenge of the Nerds was already taken too.
Nerds!
Steve Jobs, first of all, to just be really clear, Bill Gates was a nerd. That is correct.
I don't think Jobs necessarily
Steve Jobs
was.
Got laid, I guess would be the best way to put it.
He
was the cool
from
guy
from Apple
who could
at some
date,
point.
Who
they
could
asked him to
date
leave.
Girls. Who could? He was the one who had dates with girls and drove a. He was the guy who had a Camaro.
So
he
should be Wozniak.
Woz was
Gates.
Nerdy.
Nerdy. Although I guess I would argue in the definition of things, Woz gets to that geek category though because his stuff he could do things on his own, and they were useful.
Oh, Woz is a legit genius.
Bill Gates, there's credibility to it, but I mean his real big revolution was treating. The computer business like a business.
Gates is a competent, I would go so far as to say a good programmer. Woz is a legit genius.
Right. And Gates' thing, though, the whole deal of his success was being business focused. You know, so he knew to buy DOS from the guy who hacked it for whatever $16,000 and then sell it to IBM for
infinity.
A fortune. And decades of
vendor
lock-in. Basically turning into billions. And doing all the Microsoft Office 2-step.
Bundled.
There's anecdotal stories from Microsoft employees who've had code reviews by Bill Gates that say basically he's sharp. But he's no Woz.
And then the very last thing, this one doesn't fit under Trial by Fire.
Can we talk about just really quick the musical too? So they're going to have holograms, and there's going to be an app, so you can go in with the app and sign in to the musical during the musical and do interactive stuff. So what you do on your app will actually determine how the musical goes or something in there. So it's supposed to be kind of interactive. This sounds kind of neat. It's not just lame. It could be lame, somewhat interesting lame. So I might go check it out.
Ah, cool. Well, and maybe, who knows, it may be the next Hamilton. Nobody thought that was going to be a big hit.
Yeah, projection mapping, all kinds of stuff going on.
Magic.
Tupac is going to take over. He's going to take over the whole thing by the end.
He's still alive, man.
That's going to be the surprise ending. He's going to show up and shoot everybody.
Well, much like we talked about at the beginning of the show, we've gone through the same thing over and over again for the first hour of the show. And we will be back after a few minutes after these upcoming messages. I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Flicted.
I'm Barrett.
And I'm Lee.
Evie's Walk, Invisible Signs, Walk Down Memory Lane is an event to raise awareness and funds for the early onset of Alzheimer's / dementia support and services. This walk is held annually and is expected to grow nationwide. Walking together can inspire all age groups to reclaim the future for those affected by this ageless disease. Please take the first step in registering for Evelyn's Journey Walk and help to change the level of early onset Alzheimer's / dementia awareness in your community. Mark your calendars for July 9th, 2016, when the opening ceremony happens at 8 a.m. and the walk begins at 9 a.m. Starting point is Kempner High School, 14777 Voss Road, Sugar Land, Texas, 77498. You're listening to 90.1 KPFT Houston, kpft.org worldwide.
KPFT transmite por el aire 24 horas del día, 7 días de la semana y cubre diferentes tipos de gente y gente con diferentes estilos de vida. KPFT está aquí cuando usted necesita lo mejor de noticias independientes y música durante el día. Pero manteniendo este tipo de recurso no viene barato. KPFT necesita su contribución para continuar a tener esta estación única cuando usted lo necesite. Si usted está escuchando cuando se prepara por la cama o cuando se está levantando en la mañana para el trabajo, ¿por qué no hablar a la línea de departamentos de miembros a KPFT y hacer un miembro? El número es fácil. Para recordar, es 713-526-4000, extensión 314. O puede visitarnos en nuestra página kpft.org y dar su contribución. Esto es KPFT Houston.
You're listening to 90.1 FM KPFT Houston. We now return to Technology Bit.
It did. That's the way we know the Earth to be banana shaped.
This new learning fascinates me.
Tell me again how you can
how sheep's bladders there can be employed to prevent earthquakes. Well, final bit on the news, and again another one where it's in that blurry. Tonight's all blurry zones between other. Although I don't know.
Did you say blurred lines?
Would this fit? No, between no, we're very clear in our various permutations of gender here. But no. Amazon Prime Air, the drone thing. In an interview with Yahoo News, Amazon has revealed a little more about its forthcoming drone-based delivery system.
This is the thing where, like, we're not really sure if they're serious or not, but every time they talk about it, it gets a little more serious.
No, they're real about it. Yeah, they're trying to do it.
They're talking about their goals, and this makes it the clearer thing. His name's Paul Meisner, Amazon's vice president for global public policy, said they have very specific targets for Prime Air. First off, Nicolas Cage will not star in Prime Air.
Oh, man.
Give me put down the bunny.
Although you can get a blonde wig delivered in 20 minutes.
the deal is that their idea, this is their standards, this isn't what's happening today or next week. He says, quote, Prime Air is a future delivery service that will get packages to customers within 30 minutes of them ordering it online at Amazon.com. That's what he told Yahoo News. The goals we've set for ourselves are the range has to be over 10 miles. These things will weigh about 55 pounds each, but they'll be able to deliver parcels that weigh up to 5 pounds. So, darn, I was going to order a 10-pound bag of flour just because then if it crashed, it'd still be spectacular.
I guess that 50-gallon bucket of – oh, wait, someone bought that.
Yeah.
Where'd that go?
Sold it's off in Oregon.
It went
somewhere.
To Oregon. Whoa.
But it would have been easier to deliver, I bet, by drone. Although it probably would have got shot.
Just say just drop it from 100 feet. That's fine.
How will Amazon deal with drone haters with shotguns?
We talked about that a week ago. Yeah, we were ahead of the curve on that.
He isn't worried. He said, I suppose they could shoot at trucks, too. He said, we want to make the deliveries, and we believe that these Prime Air drones will be as normal as seeing a delivery truck driving down the street someday. The thing I can see is if with 10 miles, when you're talking about as the crow flies, then you have a delivery center – and then 10 miles is the radius, and that is a huge number of square miles, the circle and the radius, but square miles, that's a lot of – you can get to a lot of places that way, and you don't have to have a ton of locations to cover. Still Houston there pretty well. They would have to have a ton of stations or something. You almost wonder, and this is more – I know this sounds like – like those old Warner Brother cartoons about the future or whatever. But I mean, you really could almost see a truck driving to a particular place, and then once it hits a certain
point, everything, yeah,
the drones go off from it in a 10-mile radius and come back.
They're going to have to do that. Just like I did like 10 years at UPS with logistics and some stuff like that. So, you know, one of the things you look at like cross-dock operations, because otherwise you've got to have a distribution center every 20 miles pretty much to get – and not even that, because you'll still have little gaps where you're not covering. So you've got to scoot it in about, you know, every probably 16 miles. So, yeah, that's not viable at all. So what you do is you've got a few warehouses. And, you know, four or five times a day, you know, you roll out with your truck of drones. And as you make the routes, they zoom off where they need to zoom off to.
Or
and that's
they want
like the
it
last...
to be – or else they'll try to have it be like an ecosystem and you'll have drone nests on top of your house, drone feeders.
So that is one thing that they're talking about, like the urban airspace is going to get really crowded. So they're already starting to talk about like how they're going to cut up the airspace and say like, okay, from like 400 to 500 feet, that's going to be like a buffer zone, safety zone. No one can fly in there. From, you know, 200 feet to 300 feet, that's where the drones will operate and
go. Open season.
Yeah, and that's where they're just, that's where they'll get the distance. The Amazon stuff is kind of cool. It looks like a quadrotor until it gets up so it can go straight up and down. And this is how they'll deliver. So they'll drop it straight down. You put a little target out in your yard. They'll zoom in on the target. And then when they take back off, it's like vertical takeoff and landing. They go straight up, quadcopter style, to where, you know, they're not going to hit something else. And then once they get up into that airspace where they can then go forward, they go into almost like an airplane mode because it's got wings on it and they've got a lot of lift and they're not having to fly the rotors as much as they would with like a true quad rotor. So it's pretty smart design.
Are they, is the fuel, are they electric?
They're electric,
yeah. It's all battery.
I'm guessing you'd do one delivery and they'd swap the batteries or something.
Yeah, come back, kinda... swap the battery out, you know.
Just have enough of them and they have little, like a charging bay.
Because 10 miles out and 10 miles back probably would be exhausting what the technology would handle.
Well, it's a 55-pound drone. And the pictures that I've seen and the little, because Amazon had a little video up showing how it worked. Yeah, with little, they've had like a little video with like a little computer generated version of it. I mean, it's not like tiny, you know, it's a, you know, it's like the size of, you know, almost like a card table, maybe a little smaller than that. But it, you know, this is like a fair big size thing. And I know from flying just the little drone quads, little DJI things, that you get about 15 minutes of flight time on those. But they are fast and zippy. They have no cargo carry. I mean, they can carry a camera. It's basically they can lug a little GoPro kind of cargo. I'd imagine that these things would have fairly hefty batteries on them. Oh yeah, that's right. It was the Jeremy Clarkson
commercial.
They must have to charge.
They'll have to charge.
Probably.
For this
I mean, if they
delivery.
Get enough of them, I'd imagine they'd have a little bay. They could and they would just sort
if
of
they
take
didn't
off.
Imagine this, you know? Okay, Amazon.com. I want three cans of Pringles. And I want a 2-liter soda.
No drone
and
available.
And the drones, you know, so there's this line,
no drone available.
Constant line of drones. Cheetos. Hey, what's the limit on the weight? 5 pounds.
Man,
5 pounds of Cheetos.
If I could do that. If I could be like, if I could order junk food 5 pounds at a time, I would grow 5 pounds at a time because it really would be. There would be like the drone stream going to my house all day long.
Meanwhile, the competition is not sitting still. I've heard that Walmart is teaming up with Elon Musk, and they're putting through a series of pneumatic tubes. vacuum tubes.
They're partnering with Citibank.
I worked at Lowe's and went back at a time when nobody knew that it was a hardware store. They thought it was associated with the theater chain back in college. And they also – Lowe's didn't look like it does now. They had, like, the store part, and then they had a big, huge warehouse behind, and you'd print out the, like, tickets with anything that was too big to put on a shelf. And the thing was, from the cashiers, they would, once you checked out, they would take your ticket and put it in. They had the pneumatic tube system that ran through the whole place. And I was a cashier sometimes, and if you were on one side of the building, you could see the warehouse. And if the guys back in the warehouse part were slacking off, you just hold that tube for a minute and let it build up because the suction will build up since it's open. And you let that thing go, and then you couldn't hear it because it was too far away. But you could tell when the thing arrived because all the guys in the back would jump at the same time when that arrived.
Did you put like sandwiches and stuff in there?
They would give you a dirty look up to the front. No, we didn't send any, didn't send any food or live items or anything through that. But
didn't grab a frog and send it through the send the frog through the pee tube.
It would have been fun, but yeah, no, they you know, well, just like they do now, they sold appliances and stuff like that. So there was the things, any kind of order that was of any size, then you just drove to the back and they loaded it up for you, which was pretty, you know, pretty sweet when you bought stuff that I don't think they do anymore. Now they deliver, I think, or something. But yeah, so the vacuum tube thing, you know, they could just do that all through town, and then you could and they could carry. Although to make a pneumatic system that would carry 5 pounds might actually be a more daunting task than making a drone. That
system
could miles.
Something that could potentially kill you.
Yeah, we've had that in bank technology for like 60 years, and I still can't send more than like a roll of coins.
Yeah, they,
it. So
yeah, they
like,
have a limit on how many dollars or pennies you can send through the system. All right, well, I guess now it's time for the horror happiness of our next segment. If Licked is ready. Or did he not get ready?
I can do it here.
He's...
Bite.
Of the apple.
We're doing this like a real radio show. We got a guy in a booth playing sounds and everything.
It's semi-pro
now. We're not supposed to talk about it. Once we go meta, it's easy to become a real show. Fourth wall, man.
Right.
I almost mentioned this one earlier when we were talking about the monitoring what's going on a computer by the blinking lights. There in iOS code reference, the current iOS code from iOS 9.1 has references to possible upcoming Li-Fi. Remember, we talked about this a few weeks ago.
Li-Fi?
224 gigabits per second.
That's a lot of gigs.
And it is basically the quick definition is it's an experimental high-speed wireless networking protocol that uses pulses of light to transmit data and is being marketed as a long-term replacement for Wi-Fi. One of the things I think of when I see the Li-Fi thing, when it can do that much stuff and you can, you can put that much data out that quickly, and, you know, if you had it on your phone, imagine something where you know, I kind of think of the Li-Fi thing. One possibility would be something like, the codes, the QR codes on steroids. Is you've got a little blinking light and you hold your iPhone by it and suddenly you've got, you know, a gigabyte of data in a second, you know, or in a very, very short time, or as a sort of a Bluetooth. Well, it wouldn't work as a Bluetooth substitute because I'm guessing you got to have line of sight. Beginning with iOS 9.1, the operating system's library cache files make mention of Li-Fi capability alongside other hardware and software capability declarations. It was spotted by Twitter user Chase Fromm. Li-Fi's functionality is similar to that of an infrared remote control. Data is transmitted by rapidly modulating a light source and received with a light sensor before being reassembled into an electronic signal.
It's like the old days of having your Palm Pilot, your buddy's Palm Pilot. Like, I'm going to send you a contact over infrared.
Oh, beam it.
Beam it over to you. And it would take like 20 minutes and it would never work.
It was fast compared to your 2400 baud modem that you were using.
It was fast compared to writing it yourself.
Yeah, that was super slow. Stuff. This is literally, it's 100 times faster than most current Wi-Fi implementations. This is really quick stuff.
Yeah, unlike your television remote, Li-Fi uses visible light and the modulation happens in a manner imperceptible to the human eye. That means the same bulb that lights your hallway can act as a data access point. It's also much faster with theoretical throughput up to 224 gigabits per second.
Well, I hope it has some sort of end-to-end encryption to prevent eavesdropping, because light propagates pretty darn good. The light in your hallway is an access point.
What?
Then again, security? I don't know. I mean, really, that's no... it's just a different part of the electromagnetic spectrum. I guess it's no different from having a Wi-Fi
base station. Want to encrypt it. It's the same.
Yeah.
You know, this may be... Li-Fi may be the opening to the... Minority Report kind of future, so that if you walked in the store and you pull your device out, once it hits the lights,
boom,
there's your ad for that store, and they know that it's happening when you're on location. They don't have to track you.
Now, I didn't know this. I guess thinking about it, it's true. It just seems kind of counterintuitive. The visible light spectrum is 10,000 times larger than the entire RF spectrum, the entire radio frequency spectrum.
I guess those waves get narrower as you go up.
Yeah.
Huh, I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah, because, I mean, that's the big concern now is, you know, there's all this, you know, some of it's like quote-unquote artificial scarcity of radio frequency, you know, like, and that's why we've got, like, you know, Clear Channel, and that's why this station has to have a license to broadcast. That's why you can't just, you know, you've got to have a ham
license.
You can't just go, because the idea is, you know, there's very little actual frequency for people to broadcast on, so the government has to come in, and international standards come in, and says who can do what on certain things. So we're not talking across military ships or operational things or things like that. But this, you know, the scarcity looks like it gets removed. You know, everyone can broadcast whatever they want to, which is kind of neat.
Yeah, which, although here, you know, I'll write the Twilight Zone episode for it. Li-Fi comes out. It's a big thing. Everybody's got it on the new iPhone, the iPhone 9 or 12 or whatever. And people walk outside and take out their phone and the sunlight hits it. And it's like, is this thing on?
messages from
everywhere.
Of, the last message of God to his creation, if you're a Hitchhiker's Guide reader. Or not watcher. I don't think they talked about it. But so anyways,
224 gigabits per second. Actually, that's fast enough to where that more than outstrips the bus speed and storage speed of any device that you're going to have. your SSDs.
I love the battle there because it's gotten, you know, the speeds of various things. You know, it used to be that the limiting factor in a computer really wasn't the processor. It was the bus.
Your sad little 8-bit bus.
It was the lines that went between, the pieces, the stuff that connected up the pieces, and then suddenly now it's switched the other way, where you're going to have to put a bunch of processors on the job to saturate.
Having a transmission medium that operates at 224 gigabits per second effectively removes the bottleneck for data transfer and removes the external bottleneck for data transfer and puts it on your device instead. It's no longer a question of, like, you know, trying to cram the football through the soda straw. Now it's like you're, you know, throwing the football down a giant hallway that's wide open. It's how fast can you throw the football?
Well, or no, it's kind of more like somebody driving. It's more like somebody flying a Galaxy C5A fully loaded into your straw. You know, and so you can basically max out. I could, the Li-Fi thing, you know, from Apple's perspective, assume, you know, the problem again, it becomes that when it receives the data to write it,
Can't write
to a device that fast, so I don't know how that...
224 gigabits per second is 28 gigabytes per second. That's so far above the write rate an array
right
of flash disks.
Right now we're doing... it maxes out at about 7. Is that what the
depends on the medium
read write on SSD? Yes.
And what this would be for, I would assume that let's say you do have like an entire store full or stadium full of people or something like that, and you're doing like
exactly
networking
right.
and stuff like that. Think of that as more of a, at least at first, more of a backbone throughput. If everyone's kind of on the same frequency of light, you know, you could even be visible light versus, you know, like what you would actually need. Because I have large data needs, but even I can't think of what I could download that would take me more than a few seconds
at
that much.
Well, it seems like, it seems like the sort of
most of our servers
idea,
are a couple terabytes, you know.
Right now it's kind of your machine gets the job in kind of pieces and then assembles it at the end. I guess it would do sort of the same thing. It's just that instead of it waiting for the pieces to arrive, it's more like...
It doesn't. It just means it operates at wire speed.
These pieces, and now how about some more pieces?
It means everything operates at wire speed. I mean, I used to, when I was working at EMC, we would sell massive, big disk arrays. You know, Symmetrix DMX or VMAX disk arrays. You know, these things that are, you know, hundreds of terabytes or petabytes of mixed disk and SSD and cache, you know, with terabytes of cache in them. And even something like that, just running, you know, all out servicing, you know, thousands of guests simultaneously from a single array, you would be so hard pressed to hit 26, you know, you'd be so hard pressed to hit that. That's huge. You have to have it backed by this massive amount of switching. You've got to have SAN switches in there, and there's all this optical switching. It's just like this huge thing. So yeah, you're right. So this would mean instead of having to, like in your stadium example, instead of having to set up, you know, 300 wireless access points around the entire stadium, you could maybe do it with 10 wireless access points using Li-Fi, assuming that the line of sight
is
and all that kind of
Li-Fi
stuff.
Li-Fi is sort of one way, isn't it? Kind of broadcast.
Yeah, it's bidirectional.
Is it?
Now that assumes that the receiver. So it's much easier, just like with radios and stuff like that, it's much easier to be unidirectional, to where, it's big antennae here at the station, everyone has small antennas in their cars or what have you.
Omnidirectional.
That's more like frequency.
We're talking communication.
Asynchronous might have been the better word for that. But no, it's a bisynchronous. It goes both directions.
It's
but the
duplex.
Issue is that the listener, what would traditionally be the listeners, also has to have that frequency to be able to broadcast the light back to where the original source can pick it up. Mm-hmm. But yeah, assuming you've got two equally matched devices, they can communicate full duplex back and forth at those speeds.
I have a feeling the monetization of Li-Fi will come in the broadcast style. Because imagine, so you've got your stadium. We're broadcasting all the stats, or we're broadcasting the game.
I can't wait.
You can use your device to do replays yourself.
Yeah.
Or,
I think it'll be cool the first time someone hits a homer and knocks out the lights. Everyone's like, our Wi-Fi. Our Li-Fi.
They hit the home run and the home crowd boos.
Yeah.
you think they'll finally actually implement multicast on the internet?
No.
Because that pretty much doesn't happen.
No, that's because IP multicasting is flawed and horrible.
Now, the question is, will we be on IPv6 by then?
No.
No, actually what
probably
will happen
not.
Is we'll half-ass do IPv6, and then we'll decide we need to come up with yet another whole new thing, and we'll have a working group we'll have started on it.
My problem with IPv6 is that I don't... I understand it. Like, I've read the docs. I know what it is. I know mostly how it works. I even think I understand how it obviates the need for DHCP, and I think I've even got a pretty good understanding of how a stateful firewall works with IPv6. I just have no idea how to implement it at home. Like, what do I need to do to take my home networking setup, which includes three different web servers that are...
Are you running Linux?
I'm running Windows 64-bit. I don't have any Windows in the house.
Oh, no, it's all Linux. Linux has been shipping with IPv6 since like 4 years, 3 years, baked into the kernel. So you're pretty much ready to go.
I don't know. It just seems super complicated.
The cool thing to do would be to, just do it on a little backbone. And you used to have to, even like 5 or 6 years ago, you could go to Hurricane Electric or you get stuff that was called like a 4-on-6 or the 6-bone.
Yeah, yeah.
And what that did is it just translated IPv4 addresses to IPv6. You could actually have a bridge. You could run IPv6 at home and actually punch out and get to IPv4 sites that weren't supporting it. The cool thing is, fire up Linux, install everything, and actually shut down IPv4, and you'd be kind of surprised at where you can get along if you've got a full Linux system.
Well, the other side of it is I serve websites out of the house. I have a Comcast static IP address.
Well, are all your users coming in over IPv6 traffic?
No, I have no IPv6 presence. I would need to set up. I know I would need to get a Quad A record, and I would want to set up. Probably,
Does your provider offer IPv6?
I don't know if Comcast does business class IPv6.
Probably
or not,
but that's what I'm saying. You can get a bridge, and there's a lot of those.
So
are
you'd
free
have to
too.
Do it internally, and then you'd have.
See,
IPv6,
and then we're back into
gateway.
This being just a massive kind of pain in the butt. And why would I really even?
I was
going
to say run it at home, and just it's pretty cool as far as people talk about like zero network configuration and stuff like that. But as far as the LAN side, it's really really easy to you don't really do anything. You just say, hey, run IPv6, go. And it's a lot like the old SIP protocols.
They all get like 3, 4, maybe 5 IP addresses, IPv6 addresses.
What I was really unsure about is if there's still a concept of CNAMEs with IPv6 DNS. I know I know what Quad A records are, and I know Quad A records work mostly the same as A records.
The mapping still
works
what we're giving up. That's a different level. We're not giving up any of the DNS stuff. Well, all we're giving up is the transport layer and the addressing below that. Actually, not the transport, just the addressing.
Probably way off the reservation here, but
this is much more than our politics.
But a real question or on this that I certainly have. I've not other than knowing that IPv6 has a the technical term, I think, is a boatload of IP addresses available. So the thing to me with that is then if there's so many addresses, then the idea is every device could essentially have its own unique address.
There's actually enough to where every atom in every device could have its own unique address.
Pretty much every device will have 4 or 5 IPs, no matter what you do.
Except how is that – how do, I guess – is the idea that there's so many, how do you prevent collisions, where they have the same address?
Oh, it's top down to where it gets more specific and then less specific. And you know how we've got like net masks and how you can kind of say like, okay, all this is public and then everything below this is going to be private. And this is how we route this network. It's built a little
thing.
Bit like that. But yeah, there's what's it called? It's not the focus. It says scope. No, there's a scope, more or less a scope delimiter that says what scope you're in, IPv6 scope, and it's separated out by that. So there'll be like, you know, if we go back to the DNS example, how there are a number of TLDs that are maintained and then each TLD kind of operates its own thing and their maintainers that TLD. The scope's kind of work the same way. So there will be a number of global scopes.
It's the exact same as IPv4. Yeah. I mean, it's just bits and net masks to create boundaries.
An IANA is going to have to come in and say, hey, this is how it's going to be. And someone's going to have to regulate
that's
and say,
all,
okay,
that's
you guys
all
have this.
IPv4, though, is it wasn't originally, but it became managed by scarcity, though, because you have this block of addresses, and they ran out of addresses they could give out.
Right, right.
So that's why I was thinking, you know, so there's all the schemes. You know,
but there, but IPv6 is still regulated by the same organizations, like ARIN in the United States, RIPE in Europe.
Yeah.
APNIC and Asia-Pacific.
But there is no concept of NAT. NAT in IPv6.
Okay.
You do not NAT.
So then I guess that sort of then gets to the flip side of it, though, which is, okay, so before they had those groups because there's only so many addresses. Well, now when there's sort of infinite addresses, then still those same groups are going to control the pools. And so, yeah, you're not doing NAT to get an address at your laptop. But it's sort of
They took some of the ideas of NAT. You could still technically NAT behind
its,
that.
Like sort of fixed IP that would be its.
I mean, you could still get collisions, just like you could get collisions now, as long as you could get somebody to get a routing number for you inside the routing. I mean, people break the internet by putting some network admin putting in a wrong route and causing traffic to like. Get jacked up for people. That happens on IPv4. Oh yeah. that happens, so that could happen on IPv6 as well. Somebody could step over somebody's, or even now, like somebody at home, right? Instead of I'm going to make a private network, but instead of using RFC 1918 space, they could say house, I'm going to use 8.8.
Yeah, 8.8.8.8 is my address.
And they say my stuff is 8.8, right? /16.
Why do that at home when you can do that in the coffee shop
at the
airport,
though? And then, if you know, they can no longer get a lot of Google stuff.
Right, well, okay, but again, flipping it around, it's sort of like, gee, why do I need to get... So my machine still, though, when I hook up to a network, is going to have to get... It'll have to get an address.
There's two ways of doing it.
It seems like with all these addresses, it would make... It might...
No.
Your machine kept the same address, just where...
There's somewhat traditional DHCP. There's a managed DHCP for IPv6 that you have the option of deploying, but there's also sort of an auto DHCP.
So I was talking about the zero configuration, the local scope, which, you know, like, well, how Windows, if it can't communicate out, you'll get like the 169.
You get an APIPA address.
Yeah, so it's the same thing.
I think it's FE80, the IPv6 one.
Except instead of how APIPA is broken and terrible and means that your computer is never going to do anything. Supposedly, the IPv6
I just make that routable. Unlike my firewall rules, say route it on.
What is it? 169, 172, whatever.
Yeah.
Whatever that is.
Because 192.172 is legit, and 172 is legit, but it's a weird combination.
I know it starts with 169.
I think it's 169.254 or something.
As soon as I see like 169 dot, I'm like, oh, internet's broken. This computer is not on the network. Which is supposedly, unlike the IPv4 broken version, the one in IPv6 will just sort of work just magically.
Yeah it's 169.254.x.x.
Yeah. That's all for Technology Bytes. It all works magically.
The
it's
CIDR
Harry
is
Potter
a slash
now.
16. Yeah.
But the IPv6, is it? Did you look it up? Is it FE80? It's FE80.
Yeah, I didn't look it up, but I know it's FE80. Yeah. It's usually like FE80 2000.
I'm just not going to be remembering.
There's no way people are
going to
remember
addresses.
IPs. Yeah.
No, it's gone.
Well, that's the thing. This stuff is so complex, it's not meant to. So and that's the hardest part for me to get my head around IPv6. And this is when we got all excited about it.
It was like the numbers.
And we wanted it to go. Was that, you had to divorce yourself from the idea that you're going to know your network addresses. For the most part, you might know like a couple headers and kind of your general area. But you just have to let go of that and just kind of trust in the protocol.
I'm
going to
give you a /128.
Yeah.
Thanks.
/128.
How many is that?
a lot.
How many?
A lot.
Yeah.
And that's the big thing too. It's like, you know, we talk about, you know, the IPv4 when, you know, we're running out of addresses. It's like you can't really give out, you know, like, hey, you get an address and you get an address and you get an address. The way that it's cut up,
it's a
in the early they had to give away
into a block into
yeah
a block.
Yeah, we talk about, like, you know, when you go and you set up your home computer and you look at the netmask and everything's, you know, 255.255.255, you know, zero. It's like there's a large range and all those. So like some corporations would get, you know, they could get, you know, some blocks of like 16,000 addresses. I think the smallest block you can get is 8 with a .248,
yeah.
Or no, the smallest block. Like if you were going to get provisioned on fiber, the smallest amount of IP addresses
you can get on fiber
would be 8, because that's the smallest you can cut it up would be like the /23 or whatever, /20.
I have 22. I know for my Comcast static IP, I have a teeny tiny allocation. I have like a /31.
You can slash down to 32
is an individual host.
Yeah, but that you can't route that.
Because you don't have enough. That's a two thing, and you've got a gateway.
Because you have to have at least 4, right?
You have to have. We'd have to go to a site. Let me pull up a site.
You have to have the definition for the network, and you have to have broadcast, right?
Yep.
So if you have 4, that leaves you with 2. Mm-hmm. If you go down to 2, you don't have any available IPs because you've got the definition for the network and the broadcast and no available IPs. Mm-hmm. So you have to have 4, which is a /30.
Yeah.
The smallest.
Because most people get 29. /29 is 8 IP addresses.
Yeah.
The smallest CIDR I can configure in here is a /30.
Yeah.
With 4 hosts.
Yeah. So, and most people get, like, you know, so they'll give out, like,
It's actually 2 hosts, though. It's 4 IPs.
Yeah, 4 IPs. Yeah, 4 addresses in here.
Right.
So, I mean, it wasn't very uncommon in the early days of the internet when we never thought we'd run out. People would get like, hey, here's a /8, you know, here's
companies,
a /10.
And a /8 we're talking about here, this is classful subnet addressing as opposed to classless with a /8 or a /16. A /8 block of IP addresses is how many millions of IP addresses? It is a very large number. And companies originally, there's an extremely small number of /8s. That's like you can have a maximum of... There were like 240 some odd because there's reserved blocks of them. But companies in the 70s or 80s, maybe it was the 80s, I guess,
80s,
would get allocated by Aaron or whoever was doing the allocation. Like Boeing had a /8 at one point. You know, huge companies would just get like these millions of IP addresses.
Even bees are still pretty huge.
Yeah, /8, 16 million in a /8. There are a little over 4 million addresses in a /10. I know /16s were given out. That's 65,536.
But nobody, the thing is, nobody wants to give those up, right?
Oh, no, absolutely not. They're valuable.
For example, the thing is, they're valuable, but they don't use them. Mm-hmm. And so,
well, some companies do. Like I can tell you, having worked IT at Boeing.
Rice University has at least 5 Class Bs. Mm-hmm. They use one. And they, I think, maybe sort of used a second one a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's about it. Like the other ones, they may put something on it just so there's something on it. But
Boeing uses, having worked IT at Boeing for 10 years, I can tell you Boeing uses a huge chunk of theirs. Every site has a different IP set that they all use. And they all look, when you come in from the outside and you're used to dealing with companies that don't have routable address space, and these aren't routable, they're internal, but they're using like, I forget what the prefixes are, but it's like, you know, 132. You know, it's like, these are real IP addresses on all these computers. What's going on in here?
So when we talk about exhausting like the IPv4 space, it doesn't mean that we actually have, you know, every single IP address that's available has a device on it. It's that there are large chunks that, you know, like Flicted said, it might have like, you know, 64 million times 4, but they might only be using some of those, or, you know, I think
they're,
Moen,
yeah, they're
probably
allocated,
the,
and they'll never give them up.
Yeah, I just, the place where I was on that is that you know, there's NAT and these other things are essentially ways that you could take one IP address at your house. You know, Time Warner gives you, for normal people, gives you that one IP address at your cable modem, mm-hmm. and then you can have.
And that's
kind of
how this,
whatever,
yeah, that's what it looks like. So, like, if you look at, like, an added packet or something like that, you'll have, like, the main packet, and then it strips that away, and then it has internal routing information inside there. And really, these IPv6 addresses, this address space is very much like that. It's like you've got the address that gets, that's, you know, quote-unquote internet routable, and then once it gets to you without having to put anything in the packet or have any other kind of protocols below it, you've got, in addition to a port number, which used to be an IP address and port number, which gives you a socket, you've got a ton of information still contained in the packet, so you can route that thing all day long inside. Like Boeing could just have a ton of fun with that, with just a single IP address on the front side and still be able to route to every single device, computer, everything inside with one external IP.
And I guess on the local side, because I was looking at it from the global side, on the local side, it means that you have enough, that there's enough addresses and the way the space works that that you don't have to do
the 255 if you have LAN multiple segment, yeah.
If you have multiple Wi-Fi routers or multiple routers around, you don't have to worry about, oh well, I can only allocate, you know, or I have to come up with another net mask to have a different so that this one's not conflicting.
A lot of problems go away. A lot of new problems happen.
Yeah, it is. But, you know, we don't have to, you know, we used to worry about like ThickNet and BNC connectors and, you know, coax and crimping all that. Yeah, and, you know, how you have to like set up a computers in a hub fashion where you didn't
have hubs.
Sometimes
it's nice knowing an IP, though.
I do. That's what I'm saying. I'm having a really hard time giving up that. Like, I know, even like right now, I know not hundreds, but probably hundreds of IP addresses.
Because unless you've got, you know, unless you're running dynamic DNS, so everything is accurately updating records so you know the name of the system and can get to it, it's going to be a pain. I mean, because, yeah, you can't just say, oh, the printer, yeah, the printers are all da-da-da-da-da, you know, this one's da-da, yeah, no.
Or scanning an address space to find out where your computer is. You know, it's like, yeah, I can, like, fire up Nmap if I forget where an IP address is and say, like, okay, I know I've got secure shell on this, I know we've got this, I forgot where we put it, and scan it. Be like, oh, this is unaccounted for, very quickly identify.
How long does
when you've got a billion, your address is a
billion. How long does a sweep take from that, from a slash 128
like, you know,
IPv6
1%
go.
Done, you know, 24 days remaining. It's like, oh.
So then SneakerNet suddenly makes a lot more sense again.
First world network admin problems.
Ah, well, that was all out of the first story on Apple. This next one is not as technology-oriented, so it probably won't lead to the kind of digression. But no, this week has not been great news for Apple's new Apple TV digital media player. The first sting came from an interview that ESPN president John Skipper did with the Wall Street Journal, in which he revealed that Apple has been, quote, frustrated with its inability to form programming deals with major content providers. Now, think about what I said last week about the weird idea that may make sense. Is Apple just, like, takes off, you know, 5% of its mountain of cash, and instead of building three more headquarters shaped like UFOs, they buy Time Warner.
And then suddenly, build them a headquarters shaped like
suddenly
a UFO.
Suddenly they are in. When asked if Apple has a path to being a player in the TV industry, Skipper replied, quote, they are creating a significantly advantageous operating system and a great television experience, and that television experience is fabulous for sports. We are big proponents of believing it would be a fabulous place. Can you say fabulous some more? A fabulous place to sell. He's using fabulous a lot for a guy who's in sports, I must say. It would be a fabulous place to sell some subscriptions. We have ongoing conversations. They've been frustrated by their ability to construct something which works for them with programmers. We continue to try to work with them.
Fabulous.
So, let's see. You know, the rumors have been around for years. Then just last month, Bloomberg reported that Apple had suspended its plans for launching a TV service entirely and will instead focus on, quote, being a platform for
sneezing.
Fabulous.
A platform for media companies to sell directly to customers through its app store. So instead of doing a deal with ESPN, I guess you'd do the ESPN app. The second sting came when Recode broke the news that key Apple TV designer Ben Kieran has left the company. Recode reported that he had, quote, spent the last 3 years overseeing the look and feel of the software on the new Apple TV. His departure doesn't appear to be linked with the comments from the ESPN guy. He told Recode that he's left Apple because he wanted, quote, to create not just a killer product, but my own iconic company. Boy, that's just a terrible – that may be bad news for Apple in the course of employees, but that's not that's not the bad news, like the guy left because the thing is a bomb and a failure and he wants his name unassociated with it. This sounds more like somebody who really wants to do something more.
He thought those Nest guys did something really cool.
He noted that his decision to leave Apple was, quote, really difficult. I've totally fallen in love with the people, the culture, the product. So you know, I guess it would be interesting to see what this person will do. But so, you know, clearly Apple's still talking to people about kind of doing the online thing. It is a new and totally different approach to delivering TV. So you wonder where it's going to go. And so we'll keep an eye on it for everybody. And then the last Apple one is this one. Apple says it was a misunderstanding, but a woman, a British Columbia, Victoria, British Columbia woman, was trying to transfer her late husband's digital account to her own name after he died, and they told her that she would need a court order to make that happen, not just the usual sort of proof that somebody had died, like a death certificate. The woman's name is Peggy Bush, 72 years old, and her daughter Donna sought to have the Apple ID password of her deceased husband's account transferred to Mrs. Bush, in part because she wished to continue playing a freemium card game and presumably access other data on his iPad.
You know, I have mixed feelings about that because every company is different on what their data access requirements are for proving, you know, for proving death and continuity of access in a situation like that. Facebook, I think, has a pretty well-oiled process at this point.
A thumb.
Yeah.
I think so. You've got a mail and a thumb.
Yeah. A whole, just well, whole one or just like the part?
Just
with
a part. Because they realize that, you know, you might also have like a Google. I think Google requires a pinky.
Right. You have to distribute those out.
Is this one from ignorance, though? Because I had a relative who died suddenly a couple years ago. And I had control of her.
You with, probably already knew her passwords anyway.
Well, no, I knew one. We got one. And from that, basically, if you can check their email, which, frankly, if you're hands-on with the hardware and
reset
can open
everything.
It
yeah, just reset everything.
It, then you can ask for a password. Yeah, reset. Plus, presumably, if you've been married till you're 72 years old, you should probably know the answers to most of their security questions, so you could even reset it the old-fashioned
what
way.
What is the best strategy on that? I would think maybe like have a password manager where so you can keep rotating passwords or changing passwords or adding to it, and then maybe just having, you know, like a master password of that you don't change as often and just letting loved ones or relatives
or
your neighbor know where that password is, where they can go. And then they've got, you know, a full litany, a laundry list of all of the sites.
Yeah, some people have a flash drive.
Yeah,
they,
just
they
something
keep a flash
along
drive
lines.
Somewhere
you
that
know,
they
I've
tell
got,
somebody, like, if something happens, here's a flash drive. It's
I just use
I'm lazy.
Delete this flash drive. Look at this flash drive.
No. I just use a password manager, and I've got everything in there. I've got the password for it. Is my wife knows where it is in case
I thought
I'm,
you were going to give us the password.
No, in case I'm hit by a bus or whatever. And then in there, I've got a note at the very top of it starred that says, you know, insurance information, here's like, because for the bank, it's this phone number or whatever, and then all the passwords for all the websites are in there, so she would just have
to send them out. Their password initials is match. Is it LL?
Is it? Yeah, it's yeah.
You should know this. This is
Laura.
I'm okay for not knowing this. I'm asking you a question about your
Laura,
wife.
Yeah, L&L.
That's kind of cool. So does she have, let me ask you this, you're proactive.
Are you fishing me right now?
No, I'm not asking. You're very geeky. You've done that. Does she have the same thing set up?
Yeah,
for you.
She have it for you.
Okay,
yeah.
So it's
because I set it up.
Okay.
So yes.
Which of
so
course
your password is
you
hit by
it.
Bus, right? It's 8 characters.
Yeah, but the I is a number one, and the both S's are dollar signs.
So I'm wondering how many you guys are a geeky household. You guys are obviously thinking about, but I wonder like how many other households have a contingency plan for something like that. Or,
everyone
you know,
should. I mean, I think
yeah. Or go to some elderly uncles and aunts and grandparents that might not have any.
My
people.
Plan is my spouse basically can. To get to at least one of my devices, she can guess the PIN. Or not guess. She would know probably within
one,
three guesses.
One, two, three, four, that, five.
No, not because they're lame, but because she knows what they are.
I got to go grab my
are.
Luggage.
Right she'd be able to, she would be able to guess one of the – she would be able to get a password or you know, she'd be able to get onto one of my devices that's around, and from that it would be enough to
this
no,
is
nobody,
a good
nobody
idea.
Knows mine.
Well,
and.
Okay.
And,
nobody ever will. His devices are all set up to.
I mean,
self-destruct.
They might find somewhere.
That's what
like
I was going
to
say.
Like,
dead man
know,
switch.
He has five years ago, when I used to write down passwords, there might be some passwords written down. But now the thing is, like the holy grail, right, is to get into an email account. If you get an email account that where sites are registered with that, then you can do password resets. But I turned on two-factor authentication on everything.
That's right.
And
you're smart.
So nobody will be able to. Get into my phone to use a two-factor authentication.
Well, 2FA is so good, sometimes it even keeps you out.
Yeah, they better just hope that you don't have your phone with you when the moment comes. You know, if the deal is that you take a wrong turn and ride a Harley off the overpass that was supposed to be finished.
But this
it was
is
on your map.
Well, I guess with your passwords, you put in the 10, like, you know, you can get like 10 one-use codes, you know, for TFA, and you can do something like that.
If you do that.
Yeah, I don't usually do that. I did that one time, and I've been in the situation where I've broken the phone, the only phone that has the TFA that lets me get TFA on another machine. which is just fine.
I've done the reset on the two-factor authentication device, and then afterwards been like, when you do a restore, that part doesn't get restored.
Make the codes. If you've never messed with 2FA before, print the codes out. Put them somewhere handy. You will probably use them in your password manager.
That's a great place for them because it's
as long as your
encrypted.
Password manager is not protected by TFA, the same TFA that you're putting your TFA stuff in.
Then you get into this horrible chicken and egg problem where everything you love has been destroyed.
Which is the other way to do it. Maybe you want to share everything, and maybe what I have is I'm going to do like a little dead man switch to where if I don't hit some web server
by
11:59, everything scrambles.
Press shift, so you sleep in one weekend, and it's all gone.
See, I kind of view it like a...
I've got to go re-register at bronies.com again.
It's not that I'm doing something nice for people that want to take care of things if I pass away, but that I'm giving them a fun adventure.
Well, it can be really, I mean, okay, so in this particular case, according to the news story, the person wanted to continue playing a freemium game tied to an account. But, I mean, if one member of a household takes care of more of the electronic business than another member, you know, if one member of the household is the one who logs in, I'm making this all up, but the one who logs into the credit card website and they pay both accounts or whatever, the one member of the household takes care of the mortgage and the other doesn't know anything about it. If you are that person, you owe it to your spouse, your significant other, your live-in partner, whatever you choose to call your person. Yeah, yeah. Your cat, if it's
or
your
cats
cat.
In the case of Dwight.
You owe it to them to have some sort of plan in place to where if you are hit by, you know, a piece of an airplane that falls from the sky, they can continue with their daily life.
How's Milo going to get to his pictures?
That's right.
What's Venus going to do?
What are they going to do? Dwight?
What happens to all those Instagram photos when you're not here?
Now, I do think there's going to have to be some kind of a legal instrument where you can start, you know, bequeathing, you know, your digital domain to other people. But I would hate to be like the nephew where you're sitting and, you know, the reading of the last will and testament and, you know, like your cousin gets like, you know, my mini fortunes, you know, money's nothing, but they get, you know, $10 million into.
But
my nephew Barrett, you know, I give him my Pinterest account, which I've spent countless hours, you know, looking over
Barrett,
this and poured my heart, life, and soul.
Barrett
everything.
Gets
like,
my verified.
No, I want the cash.
My verified Twitter account with 2 million followers. I bequeath to you.
Yes.
Treat it wisely.
50% pots, but that's cool.
And yes. And jackpotsgoodtime27.com.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Wow. Thanks.
I mean, in all seriousness, you could put something like that in your will and leave. I mean, I'm not an estate lawyer.
Or say who the passwords would go to. I would assume. Yeah, I just don't think anyone's quite doing that yet. But I think with so much, quote, you know, digital domain stuff now, I think that's going to start to be a thing.
This is definitely a thing.
And to my younger brother, Larry, I leave weaselteats.com.
I wonder if anybody's got
registration
that
fee due on June 7th.
Yeah, a lot of things like that. Ascension, you know, like the domain name, for the most part, it's registered to one person if you're not setting up to
Although
a corporation or trust.
Although you're kind of leasing it, and so the deal is the TLD owns the domain name. You just
mostly
buy the use.
There are a few that are set up
time.
A little bit differently, but for the most part, it's a lease company.
Oh, hey, weaselteats.com is available.
I don't know if you can say that online. On the air.
Sure you can.
It's not one of the seven words. Because it's not.
I don't think they had that foresight. I don't think George Carlin was thinking that far ahead at the time.
There's all kinds of variants on it you could buy, too. Like .io is open. .net's, of course, open.
Well, in the last bit of the time we have, we should probably play an intro and do a little more. And, you know, for the stuff, in case we didn't get to it or go to the depth you wanted, you can go to geekradio.com, and there's links to all the articles that we kind of referenced tonight as far as through the news and that kind of stuff.
Which intro are we playing?
Which is intro Flicted
do
doing
play?
It?
One. Flicted. I have to Got ask. It. Which intro are we playing?
Flicted has a button.
In the geek world, we hear about new gadgets and gizmos every day. But can they stand a dip in the snark tank?
All right, this is more of a I wanted to see what the thoughts were from the people who are into the kind of Arduino Raspberry Pi world. This is from Lifehacker, and although via Make magazine, which Make is legit. If you're interested in the whole Maker thing, I certainly recommend pick up a copy of it, and I think you'll get a lot of interesting ideas. the question on how do you choose between a Raspberry Pi and an Arduino if you're doing a project. And what their suggestion is think about what you want your project to do. If you can describe it with less than two ands, get an Arduino. If you need more than two ands, get a Raspberry Pi. Does that make sense?
Barrett, you're the maker on staff.
I wanted to BS test that one with you.
Kinda. It's a pretty... I mean, really what it comes down to is if you need any kind of display or any kind of horsepower, you know, go with a Raspberry Pi. If you just really need simple... And they're talking about, like, I think, descriptive ands, not, like, comparative operators.
Oh, yeah.
Nerds! Yeah, joking. But, I mean, really what it comes down to, the two are so far apart these days, it's a little bit crazy. When you talk Arduino, you're talking 12 megahertz, maybe 20 megahertz on some of the faster ones. There's no display. There's no anything. You do your debugging the hard way.
JTAG or something?
Yeah, or JTAG or even just like blink or don't blink on this. You know, you've got to like do old school debugging. Whereas Raspberry Pi, it's pretty much it's a full-blown Linux computer. And Windows is trying to come out with an operating system to load up on the Raspberry Pi.
Do they have their own Ubuntu distro?
Yeah. So there's a lot of things you can do out there. So, yeah, Raspbian is like the default thing. So I would just say... Actually, for the hobbyist, for the noob, I think Raspberry Pi is easier, if not ever so slightly more expensive, because you actually get a full-blown computer. You can see what's going on. If something doesn't boot, you can get eyes on it. Versus the other one, you really kind of have to know what you're doing, because it's very hard to even get software on there and do anything. So that's cool. My take. Get them both.
I figured that was a good discussion to open, because I've seen both, and they kind of get talked about. In some ways, they get talked about interchangeably. And so that
yeah, they're not at all interchangeable. I would say they're
as
night
far as
and
purposes.
Day.
I yeah, guess the thing is, if you know enough that you want to make a dedicated piece of hardware that only does one thing, then the Arduino makes sense mm-hmm. if you want to go through the trouble. Mm-hmm. Versus the more flexible. The Raspberry Pi.
No, the cool thing is about Arduino is it's been around for so long that there is just a huge ecosystem and a huge community and a ton of code examples and libraries and people that have done just about everything you could want to do already. So as far as, you know, if you want to go do what was it, Stack Overflow? If you want to go do the copy-paste, you know, kind of method of coding, it's very easy
yes.
to go do this in
Stack
Arduino
Overflow
land.
Or SOD,
SOD
Stack Overflow-driven
yeah.
development.
That's funny.
So the next item under Try, Buy, or Fry, this one's... very clever and hopefully will get cheaper. LG, it's an ultra short throw LED smart projector. What does that mean? It means that you can
only
put
throw it
this 5
far.
Inches you can put it 5 inches away from the screen or wall and it will do video 1080p video at up to 100 inches diagonal.
It looks like it's got some kind of funky Fresnel lens or however you say
that. I think
that.
Yeah, it reflects back to and I'm assuming that mirror.
Oh, I see. It looks like it yeah. goes, and it's got
yeah,
like a...
Yeah, projects here and then goes up
and
there. So
I'm
you're going
to sure
set
that
it lower
curve
than
is
your...
to make it display correctly when it hits the flat surface.
You can't see our hand motions, but we're totally like describing this here.
Curves and circles and stuff.
I liked it better when it was like, you know, like throwable. Like, what movie was that? That was the follow-up movie to Alien, where they had the probes that would go down and map everything out.
Prometheus.
That looks cool. Prometheus, yes.
Which was the prequel, right? Or was that or was it a follow?
It was a prequel. It came out later.
Prometheus was the prequel to the Alien movies, and it's going to be followed up by its sequel, Prometheuses, which is an alien show.
Shouldn't that be Promethei?
That ruins the joke.
The deal with this, so it'll do 100-inch video while resting as little as 5 inches away from the screen or wall. Its LED light source delivers consistent, vivid color and will last for roughly 30,000 hours.
That's a lot of hours.
Built-in smart TV features means you don't need a separate box to get your content, and Bluetooth output means you can connect speakers without running wires.
So 30,000 hours of life, but is there a replacement bulb option?
Or do you have to just buy another one?
Yeah, or is it just you short throw it into the trash?
It's LED, yeah, it's
I'm
probably...
assuming that it is a replaceable thing because...
That was always the big expensive item for any kind of projector is that bulb, that multi-hundred dollar
looking at,
monster
looking at the
bulb.
Picture, it's like barely got more space than whatever it takes to power
yeah,
the
this
bulb
is kind of funny now.
And have some ports.
That form factor reminds me if you could pretend that the reflector, the mirror there, or the lens is a handle, it almost looks like the old... cassette recorder machines about the same size, about
old,
that
old
same
ones.
The old ones that you know you'd check out from the elementary school.
You hold with the handle that comes out.
But yeah, going by the Ethernet port on there, it looks like it's probably about the same size, about the same depth.
It's about $1,400. The thing to me that you know, the kind of like obvious easy use to me on this is somebody who's performance art type thing or DJ type deal where you get a few of these and you can just put them by any walls. And
you
then
have somebody buy one.
And then the tough part is it's $1,400 each. That's not the big expense. The big expense is paying the guy to make sure that people don't take these and throw them in their purse while you're not looking.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Also kind of looks like the Ghostbusters trap. You know what I mean?
I looked into the trap, right?
Paint it gray and yellow, throw it out there, and you can actually project ghosts that you could go magically catch in the trap.
Truly, the future is now.
We just need a bunch of these for the next anniversary geek gathering to project cool stuff on the walls upstairs at Cones.
We might be there. We'll see. Give it another year.
Or there'll be like more easy direct projection ones that'll be cheap. Because see, for $1,400, you could buy a lot of lower res ones because they're about. You can get a 720p
right?
For about $300 now.
Eh.
It's probably not going to throw the kind of light,
cheapy.
Not going to do it as close to the wall.
Well, they made some. I bought a couple of years ago. I bought a toy one for like $39. It was super low res. It only works about like 4 feet back from a wall, but for just a little office or funsy setting, good $30.
Well, if we've got the 100-inch screen that you can put up on the wall. If you're wanting to watch alone. This looks like something out of a cartoon.
This loops back to when we were talking about Astroworld a little bit.
Yeah, Astroworld and
this is like the official version
solo theater
of the cardboard box.
Solo theater. The only thing this lacks is a tape outline to put around where you're laying to watch it. What this is basically in Japan where apartments are really small and privacy is hard to find. They're not like us where they've got like two bedrooms and a bathroom per person in the household in their homes. You know, they don't have the McBarns that some of us live in.
They have one jute rug.
They have like the one
article.
Room. And so the idea is this solo theater is a thing where you basically lay down on your back and you put this box over your head.
With an iPad.
And then you have an iPad is strapped to the
Or an iPhone in some of the pictures.
To the top of the box. So imagine you're laying on your back with a box on your face that stands on the floor and there's a hole underneath it like a doghouse, and then the device you're watching goes on top of it.
It's basically like holding the phone over your head while you're in bed, except automatic.
Hopefully, if you fall asleep, won't wake up with a confession several hours later.
The cost of watching movies by yourself like that, or you could do, you could lay in bed and do that if you're that lazy. It's a way to watch something.
Movies.
It's only $30, so this is not.
It's only $30, and honestly, it looks like if you've got 10 spare minutes and a cardboard box, you could probably make one yourself.
What it is, it looks like it's Google Cardboard on steroids. Very large version with the base where you lay down,
but without actual VR.
No VR,
it's
no anything else. It's just
a screen in front of your head at a fixed distance.
And I'm assuming, that's not even. It's not. Yeah, like you said, it's not two different channels for each eye.
But if you're a true
it's just a thing.
If you're a true geek, then you look at this and you take the concept and you put in some speakers, put in surround sound so that there's some speakers are behind your head.
I mean, you could just
and
wear
some
headphones.
Are up at the front.
Just saying. Headphones on.
And you could probably use a Raspberry Pi and have it control like light, have a light show thing going.
It's getting really complicated.
But you start with a cardboard box and do whatever. You can have your solo theater experience.
Oh, that's sad. They're so short on space right now. They're calling this like a way to get their third space. The way to get privacy is to go hide inside a head box. That's what they're saying. That's
just
what it comes down
lock
to.
Lock your head away.
Yeah, it says cultural forces are powerful too. Notes Michiato Abe, sociologist at Konin University. It says Japanese must don a public mask for their hierarchy-bound open plan offices and a second face for their families, turning to small private boxes at home as their way of searching for a third space.
I think they should go a different route. You know, there's that plastic, if anybody's played Dead Rising, I think is the one where you're in the mall.
Oh, yeah.
And there's the one with the plastic kid's toy head. You know, there's that big kind of, it's not the Lego one. There's another, maybe it's Duplo or one of those. It's got this head, and it's a big cylinder. It's like an upside-down bucket, but the neck is a little bit narrower, and it's got a face drawn on it. And the hero can, wear this and run around with this on his head. So you put the theater inside that, and then you can kind of, your Japanese family that's all lonely can sit in a row on the couch with these plastic heads with faces drawn.
They can all be alone.
I was talking about that made me think more of that cat that will jump into any size box.
Maru.
That's in Japan.
Maru.
They like boxes.
He's just wanting some time alone. Can't you understand?
The internet follows me everywhere.
Well, I believe that Mr. Lee, unless he wins a scratch-off game while he's out of town, will be back next week.
We send him to bring back more free AOL hours.
Yes, please.
We're running out of bandwidth.
And some flannels.
Yes, please.
Bring the flannels back. But, so you have just successfully wasted another 2 hours of your life listening to various geekery that you can now go to work tomorrow. Sound like you know a lot more about IPv6 and stuff like that.
That's certainly more than we do.
So we will all be, hopefully, all be back, and maybe we'll find out where Groovehouse is. We'll send out a search party. We'll all be back next week. So you've been listening to Technology Bytes. I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Flicted.
I'm Barrett.
And I'm Lee.
We're out. See you next week.
Thank you to everyone who gave during our December year-end campaign. Your contributions in December brought KPFT to a high we have never seen before. The previous year, spirits were high when Houston came together and boosted KPFT with $30,000 in gifts. You more than tripled that this year and were very thankful. Whether it's the elections or the exciting cultural landscape, 2016 is going to be an important year. If you missed your chance to give, you still can anytime at kpft.org. Thanks for your support of independent music, ideas, arts, and culture. This is 90.1 KPFT Houston. I'll give a little bit, I'll give a little bit of
my love to you. Make your gift to KPFT go twice as far. Many employers sponsor corporate matching gift programs that will match any charitable contribution made by their employees. To increase the value of your gift, contact your human resources office to see if your company has a matching gift program and obtain the appropriate form. Follow the instructions on the form and mail it to KPFT, 419 Lovett Boulevard, Houston, Texas, 77006. We'll verify your gift and notify your company. Your employer may also match your volunteer time. Ask your human resources office for eligibility requirements. Participating in your company's matching gift program is a simple yet powerful way to increase your support of KPFT without any additional cost to you. Don't delay. Get your company to match your gift to KPFT today. You are listening to commercial-free, listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio, 90.1 KPFT, Houston.